Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Come election day in November, you'll have more options than ever before to cast your ballot. And that's because California become the first state to shift to an all-male voting format from the presidential race on down. We'll hear from the person who has to make that happen in L.A. County. Plus, we'll hear from an expert on what we can expect now that the state is in phase two of coronavirus reopening. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us. It's the first Monday after many retail shops and other areas reopen for business. So a little later in the show, we're going to talk to one resident epidemiologist about whether we played it safe. Plus, why women are experiencing higher rates of unemployment during this pandemic and what can be done about it. All that's coming up. But today, we start with elections. On Friday, Governor Gavin Newsom signed an executive order requiring election officials to send mail-in ballots to every registered voter ahead of the general election. And for some California counties, that might not be too difficult to pull off. At least 14 counties mailed ballots to every voter this past March as part of California's new Voters' Choice Act, but L.A. was not one of them. You might remember those long lines at those vote centers. Now, late last month, the L.A. Board of Supervisors voted to send in mail-in ballots to every registered voter in the county. So we've had a little head start on the process. But after the governor's announcement, we wanted to check in with L.A. Registrar Recorder Dean Logan to see how preparations are going. Dean, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you. Now, it may seem like a long, long time ago at this point, but it's been a little over 2 months since our last election. Long lines, technical issues led to calls for mail-in ballots for all voters. With November just 6 months away, how close is L.A. County to making Governor Newsom's mandate a reality?
So I think the good news is we know that the providers that we rely on for basic materials in terms of the envelopes, the ballot printing, the processing of the assembly of the vote-by-mail packets and getting those into the mail stream have confirmed that they do have the capacity to do this. It is interesting, as you indicated, it's not quite the same as it is for other counties, simply because our voter registration population in L.A. County is larger than 42 states in the United States, and so the equivalent for us, the equivalent of adding the additional voters to the vote-by-mail file is the addition of the size of a San Diego County or an Orange County. So we're talking about another 2.1 to 2.5 million vote-by-mail packets that have to be prepared and ready to go. So a lot of it is just about logistics. It's about making sure that we have adequate staffing levels, that we have a facility so that when those ballots start coming back in, that we have the ability to kind of stay on course with getting them processed and ready to be counted so that we don't have any further delays in that process going forward. So a lot of it is simply just working on those logistics and making sure that we have the adequate facilities and resources to do this successfully.
The 2.5 million number you mentioned, is that the additional amount of ballots that you'll have to print for November?
That's right. So in the March election, we mailed ballots to about 63% of the voters in LA County. That was a combination of voters who were registered as permanent vote-by-mail voters, voters who requested a ballot simply for the March election. And then new this year, we had precincts that were in districts that shared with Orange County. And because of the Voters' Choice Act, any of those precincts became automatic vote-by-mail voters in the March election. So that was a significant increase to go to 63% in March. And so now we're just expanding that to where every registered voter in the county will receive a ballot.
Now, no cost is a factor in all this. Materials, postage, and the CARES Act passed by Congress had, what, $400 million for local election safety projects. But that money split up amongst the states. Dean, do you guys have the funds, the money in pocket to make this change happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean when I talk about resources, is this is not something that can be done without some further investment. So as you indicate, the CARES Act did allocate $400 million. That was nationwide to support efforts to address election issues in response to the COVID-19 situation. We expect that California will end up getting about $36 million of that. And then while it hasn't been fully determined yet, if you then look at the distribution amongst the counties, LA County's probably poised to get about $9 million in that pool. Our estimate of the net increased cost of moving from where we were in March to where we need to be in November is about about $10.5 million. So we will eat up that CARES Act fund fairly quickly, and then we'll be working with the county and the state, especially in light of the governor's order, to look for additional resources to support this going forward.
Considering that it seems like the governor has made this a priority, that extra million, million and a half you might need, what are the chances that, well, it seems likely that you'd get it, right? Because if it's a priority for him, he'd want you to have it.
We certainly think so. I think it's absolutely been indicated both in the announcement of the decision to go to statewide vote by mail. Legislators, the two chairs of the elections committees and the legislature have weighed in and talked about the need for the state to provide resources, and resources not just in terms of funding, but also support for counties in terms of, while we're mailing ballots to every registered voter, we are still going to have these in-person vote centers. And in light of the pandemic, the ability to get locations to open their doors for that purpose and to get people in our community to work at those vote centers is a critical piece of this as well. And so there has been widespread recognition of that. At the same time, we know that the economic impact of COVID is much broader than just the election. So while it's encouraging that there has been verbal support and advocacy for funding, I think it's going to be important for us to be at the table and pushing for those funds to ensure that November has the resources that it needs.
What kind of technology or additional technology will the county need to pull this off?
Yeah, so for the in-person vote centers, LA County has our new voting system that was rolled out for the first time in March. You had indicated there were some issues with that. Those issues are being addressed. We will use that equipment at the in-person voting sites. The big change now will be the importance of kind of addressing personal protective equipment, so making sure that the workers have face masks, that we have gloves, and that we have sanitation equipment so we can disinfect the equipment and the workspace after each voter has voted, those kind of things. And so that's, fortunately, if you want to look at it that way, we've had an opportunity to conduct a couple of special elections in this environment already. So in fact, right now we're conducting one tomorrow, May 12th, is the special election in California, Congressional District 25. And so we're getting a jump start on kind of making sure we have the procedures and stuff in place. But as you indicate, on the vote-by-mail side, it's more in our centralized environment, the need for expansion of our signature verification systems, equipment like extraction machines that we use to open the envelopes and just to get the ballots out of the envelopes and prep them for counting. So that's just an incremental increase in the operation that already exists, and that's why we need more space and more equipment to meet the demand.
We're talking to LA County Registrar and Recorder Dean Logan. When you start talking about major shifts in elections, usually the people that are most affected live in low-income communities, many of them communities of color. What's it going to take to make sure that participation doesn't drop off this November, in your view, Dean? And how much of those efforts will be led by the county?
Well, I think that's a real important point, and that's something that we have talked about very extensively in LA County, literally from the day after the March election going forward, that it's certainly, given the pandemic and the conditions that we're operating under, it is prudent to increase the vote by mail to make sure that that's kind of the fail-safe, that every voter gets a ballot in the mail. But we know in LA County that there are populations that, for a number of different reasons, are either resistant to voting by mail or unlikely to receive a ballot by mail. And that is why it's so important that we have to recognize that vote by mail itself is not a panacea for all of those things. We still have to have in-person voting options so that voters who misplace their ballot have a place to go and get a new ballot or to cast their ballot. For voters who need a language assistance, if they had not requested a ballot in a particular language, the in-person voting experience will allow for that. And then for our voters with disabilities, to be sure that we have an accessible option. So we are going through a process now, working closely with stakeholders and looking at the demographics of the county to make sure that the distribution of those in-person voting locations is targeted to meet those needs. And one of the things that we saw that was very successful in the March elections were the mobile units that we were able to take into communities where there were particular needs during that 10-day period before the election, and basically meet people where they are in the community and provide them that opportunity to cast a ballot. That's still going to be important in November. We're just going to have to do that in a way that also provides for the safety and security of the voters as well as the election workers.
You mentioned the safety safety precautions or the things that you're thinking about in terms of safety for people that want to go into these vote centers to vote? I know on Friday you announced a new vote center in Lancaster, but let's just say COVID-19, Dean, is still an issue, still a concern come November. Will vote centers still be an option for people?
Well, it looks like they will be at this point. I mean, the thing about the COVID-19 situation is it's a fluid situation and it's changing all the time. So we are in regular contact with the Department of Public Health locally here in LA County, as well as following the executive orders coming from the governor's office statewide. Right now, based on what we're seeing and how we're conducting the special elections, we've been able to have success with that. And it's clear that there are voters who desire that and need that. So we've been averaging about 120 voters per day at our vote centers in this special election. Obviously, November, much higher turnout expected. You add on to that the fact that the California allows for same-day voter registration. So places like college campuses and places in our very urban areas where people are very mobile, it's going to be important that we still have that opportunity for people to have access to get a ballot in and to vote. Now, any change in the pandemic, any increase in the restrictions put on by the Department of Public Health, we, of course, will have to respond to that in turn. But I think right now what's important is to prepare for high turnout, high participation in the November election, and also to scale up. And in the event that the restrictions are imposed, then we can always roll back.
That's LA County Registrar Recorder Dean Logan. Dean, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, staying with elections, it's been nearly 7 months since Congresswoman Katie Hill resigned her seat in the face of a House ethics investigation, and intimate photos were published online without her consent. And tomorrow, as you heard Dean Logan just mention, a special election will send a new member to Congress in Hill's place. As KPCC's Libby Denkman reports, coronavirus has taken center stage in this competitive race in North Los Angeles and Eastern Ventura counties.
It's hard to overstate how profoundly things have changed in the 25th Congressional District since the March primary. Instead of door knocking or in-person debates, campaigns for Republican Navy veteran Mike Garcia and Democratic Assemblywoman Christy Smith are suddenly playing out on Zoom, like this recent Santa Clarita Valley Chamber of Commerce candidate forum.
We thank you for joining us today for this unique virtual forum format.
And issues like ending stay-at-home orders and allowing businesses to reopen have taken center stage.
I think the most important thing we can do is to remind people to continue to stay safe at home.
That's Christy Smith, who says the federal government's response to COVID-19 has been scattershot. Mike Garcia says he supports the president's plan to restart the economy.
You know, this is where the health experts really need to be consulted and listened to as well.
Garcia signs dot the hillsides around many parts of the district, including at a recent Open Up protest in Palmdale. Linda Enos had a hard time holding up a big poster board on a hot and blustery high desert afternoon. It read, "Honk to reopen California."
People are losing their jobs, their incomes. They're destroying our economy.
Enos says stay-at-home orders may get in the way of typical get-out-the-vote efforts, but she and her fellow protesters have all the motivation they need.
This is hindering a lot of it, but I think it's waking up a sleeping giant as well.
Polling indicates protesters like Enos represent a fringe position. Californians are more concerned about shelter-in-place orders ending prematurely. Hillary Chardine is the chairwoman of a local liberal group called CA25 United for Progress.
I feel like we should be relying on things like data and scientists.
She says the Open Up demonstrations she's observed look like a way for Republicans to energize their base.
It was a whole bunch of people wearing Make America Great Again hats. It, from all appearances, was just a political rally.
On paper, former Newhall School Board member Christy Smith should be the odds-on favorite to keep the seat in Democratic hands. First-time candidate Katie Hill defeated Republican incumbent Steve Knight by nearly double digits when 2018's blue wave swept 7 California Republicans out of Congress. But Chardine says during that race, Democratic activists felt like a scrappy band of underdogs. After Hill's abrupt resignation,
this time around, I think people are tired. It's tough to get people to keep up their energy and keep up their enthusiasm.
She has not been able to generate the excitement that Katie was able to generate.
That's Republican Mayor R. Rex Paris of Lancaster. He remembers a staff member leaving him in the dust when Hill arrived at events.
Katie's in the room. She disappeared. She went to Katie. It was that magnetic. It was really quite a phenomenon.
And that reduced enthusiasm is what has Democrats concerned about losing this seat. How the virus will change turnout here is a big question mark. The process of voting looks very different than it did in March. As a safety precaution, Governor Newsom ordered counties to send every registered voter a mail-in ballot. But there will also be a limited number of in-person vote centers, like this one outside of a brewery in Palmdale.
Everything's been going good. We've had good turnout.
LA County election worker Stephen Toro sounded a little muffled behind his mask.
The fact that I'm out here and people that want to vote, whether it be one person that voted or 100 people that voted, the fact that we're out here is, it's a great feeling for us.
Toro says his team sanitizes ballot marking machines, tables, even ballpoint pens before and after each use. They're also enforcing social distancing.
We have sanitizers, we have Clorox wipes. We're here to provide gloves and masks if needed to the people that are coming to vote and they happen to not have it. We're here to provide it.
No matter the outcome on Tuesday, Garcia and Smith will face each other again on the November ballot for a full term in Congress. I'm Libby Denkman.
All right, this just in, about an hour ago, LA County beaches set to reopen on Wednesday with some rules in place, though. And businesses got the green light, at least some of them, to reopen over this weekend. California now moving into phase two of its recovery and reopening. So that doesn't necessarily mean, though, that we're going to slide right into phase three tomorrow. There are a few key things that have to happen right now that'll take us to the next stage sooner rather than later. We'll ask an expert what protocols have to be in place to make it a reality when take two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. Today, Director of LA County Public Health Department, Barbara Ferrer, reported 591 new cases of COVID-19. That brings the new totals for the county to 32,258. Now, it's not a small number, and it's something to think about as the state and many cities in Southern California continues to roll out phase two of reopening plans. It began this weekend, and it's expected that more small businesses will resume operations in a limited fashion later this week. In fact, LA County beaches will reopen Wednesday with certain rules in place. 6 feet distancing and masks are going to be required. Parking, bike paths, piers, boardwalks are all still going to be closed. So with all that, let's answer some of your burning questions about all of it. Dr. Robert Kim Farley is with UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health and a former staffer with the Centers for Disease Control. He's on the line to guide us through all this. Dr. Kim Farley, welcome back.
My pleasure, Amy.
Now, on Friday, we all moved into phase two of reopening the state, and this included allowing retail shops such as bookstores, clothing stores to sell stuff again, mostly curbside for pickup. But from what you personally observed, how do you think it all went?
Well, from personal observation, not that I've driven around Los Angeles County to see every place, but in my own neighborhood, just when I was walking down the street with my mask on, I might add, I guess it's working as intended.
It does seem. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay, good. I think we're relieved that at least you saw some of the good things that we've been doing here. Now, on that note, there's talk that we can be moving into phase three. That means reopening close proximity businesses such as hair salons, nail salons, barber shops, gyms, movie theaters as early as this week, possibly. So what do you advise Californians to keep in mind as we move closer to that possible phase?
Well, yeah, I think that we have to realize that although these additional venues are opening up, it's not going to be business as usual. So additional spacing will be needed between clients, wearing their face coverings, not having large numbers of people sitting around in waiting rooms, disinfecting high-touch surfaces, that sort of thing will be a part of that phase.
Yeah, so I definitely think, Doctor, that even though they'll be reopening at some point, it won't be the same as when they were open before. In other words, if I go to a barber shop to get a haircut, I'm not going to be sitting right next to someone, more than likely, you think?
Exactly right. Hey, I think you got it.
Now, as California slowly eases into all this, one listener who identified herself only as Aaron asked a two-part question, and here it is. Are people who are following social distancing and quarantine guidelines still contracting the virus? I'm wondering if people are getting it at the grocery stores or if they are more directly exposed through either their jobs or family members in their homes. So, Dr. Kim Farley, do we have any idea where most of the exposure to the virus is occurring?
Well, Aaron has brought up a very good question, and I think that we really just simply don't have all the risk factor data on current new cases to better understand, you know, exactly where they are contracting virus. We do have some intimations in the sense that we are seeing that in the graphs of areas hardest hit by COVID-19 in LA County, it is in the lower socioeconomic areas. I think we're seeing that, you know, continued transmission occurring there. This often may be a disproportionate people that are working in essential jobs that require them to be physically present, like, you know, grocery stores, et cetera. And they may also be living in conditions that's difficult to physically distance, you know, crowded home environments that make it more difficult that way. And for them, as well as for others around, we still do see people, obviously, that are not practicing proper physical distancing measures. And I think that's another thing that can be contributing.
Yeah, and that's something that I saw in my neighborhood, Doctor, that was a little bit of a bummer. I saw a lot of cars on my block and heard a lot of laughing. Obviously, something was happening in someone's backyard that weren't involving the people that live there all the time. And that kind of thing kind of it made me think, well, okay, well, one weekend that things start to reopen a little bit and it seems like everyone's overreaching a bit. Even though you saw something good in your neighborhood, Doctor, when it comes to this idea that we're opening up again, how much caution should we still have on this? Should we just still kind of remember that we're not all the way open just yet?
Yeah, I think that's the important thing. And I think that to the degree in which we can also kind of remind each other about that, too, about physical distancing has not gone away, and that we need to continue to practice these good hygiene measures so that we can keep these numbers in a manageable realm and we're not going to be overloading healthcare systems.
Okay, now you mentioned how you were wearing a mask when you were out and about a bit. So on that note, as more people come out of their homes and start going to businesses, we thought it'd be a good opportunity to refresh people's memories on masks, which lead us to Carol Farr's question. And this is her question. If you are 6 feet apart and there's no coughing or sneezing going on by the other family members, do you still have to wear a mask?
I think the important thing here to Carol's question is that, you know, if you're in a home setting, within your own family, not, you know, extended family members coming over, you wouldn't need to be wearing a mask to practice social or physical distancing because you're within your own home. But if someone is, you know, going outside of the home frequently, that may be an exposure setting, then perhaps that's being used for high-risk persons in the home, you know, the elderly or those with pre-existing conditions. I'd say, for example, someone is working in a healthcare setting when they're coming back home. Again, maybe for them when they're talking to elderly grandparent, that's the time when they may still wish to be wearing a mask.
Because one of the things I saw is I keep bringing up my neighborhood doctor, and I don't mean it to make it seem like it's the worst place in the world, but the neighbor across the street, I saw. It's an older couple and their kids came over and they were very far apart in their front yard. One was in one corner, one was in the other. It's almost like they were doing a four corner kind of thing. Each one as far apart as they were, but they were talking to each other. They clearly were 6 feet away from each other, a lot further than that. And I was thinking, I wonder how that kind of would look. It sounds like it's okay. They weren't wearing masks. Does that pass the muster at all?
Yeah, that would pass the muster in the sense that, you know, as long as you're practicing, you know, greater than 6 foot distancing. It sounds like a good way, in fact, to be able to at least physically see, if not, you know, obviously hug their grandkids or kids that were there that they might have been wanting to. But it sounds like they're quite cognizant of what needs to be done.
We're talking to Dr. Robert Kim Farley. He's with UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health and a former staffer with the Centers for Disease Control. And we're reaching him on his cell phone, so that's why the connection is a little bit spotty right there. Doctor, now, the weather is obviously beautiful. Trails are reopening. However, many listeners have written in with some concerns, and Annie Fox wrote this. Eaton Canyon may have been open, but Cattle Canyon was nuts. There must have been thousands of people crowding together by the river. Is the U.S. Forest Service monitoring crowding? Now, to add to her question, what do you think people should keep in mind when going out for a hike and getting some fresh air on these trails? What are the best practices for navigating around other people?
Good question, from Annie. The Forest Service local managers are being tasked with the monitoring of their areas and letting congregations of people. However, obviously, enforcement may vary, and it's hard that people will try to be responsible and abide by the physical distancing guidelines. I think that's an important issue. In terms of best practices for navigating other people when you're on such a trail, first of all, just to recognize that getting out, exercising, being out of doors and safely is a good for one's physical as well as mental health. However, when you are coming and walking up, or you're going to be near someone within the 6-foot distancing, that's when you need to go ahead and make sure that you're, you know, putting your mask on as you're passing on the trail, for example.
I know that L.A. County beaches are reopening. We just found out about an hour ago that L.A. County beaches are set to reopen on Wednesday. Doctor, I realize that stuff started to reopen a little bit on Friday and through the weekend. Now that you hear that beaches are going to reopening, what's your initial thought on having the beaches on a limited basis with rules in place still be open? Are we doing it too fast? Is it all a little bit too much, too quick?
I think the main thing at this stage, A, will be making sure that it is being monitored. Just as you may have recalled, a week or so ago, Governor Newsom had to close down the beaches just because the monitoring that was being done showed that in some areas there was not practicing physical distancing. So I think maybe because of that experience, hopefully Californians going to the beach will say, look, I remember that. I don't want to have the beach closed again. So I'm going to make sure that I'm practicing proper physical distancing when I'm at the beach. So I'm hopeful that people will try to indeed practice what they know they should be doing when they're at the beach.
Now, lots of other questions coming in about visitation now that the stay-at-home order is easing up a bit. One listener asked, can I visit my family at their house or mine? I have not seen them face-to-face since the stay-at-home order. I miss them. I see so many people with their families like everything is normal. Are they just breaking the orders? I want to obey our government authorities. What would you advise at this time, Dr. Kim Farley?
Yes, again, ideally, they should be continuing to practice physical distancing until we're told otherwise. And this is especially for others that are not living within our own immediate family in our own homes. And especially, I think, limiting contact in high-risk situations. For example, if there is someone who's elderly or who has underlying medical conditions, this is something, again, that should be a little bit of a red flag about visiting them at this stage. Obviously, there's some essential need, like taking food to a family member who's maybe not able to get out or needs some assistance. That's appropriate.
I'm still doing air hugs with my granddaughters, Doctor. I drop off some stuff and I step back and then I do like a little air hug with them, just to have some feeling of things being normal. Now, another topic we're receiving quite a few questions on is air travel. And one listener wrote, I will be picking up my grandmother at LAX this week. She is traveling from Mexico to Los Angeles. Does she need to self-quarantine for 2 weeks before going to my mother's house, which is who she is staying with? Now, for those traveling to our area this time, what are the best practices when it comes to isolation and quarantine?
I think the situation is, again, trying to look at each situation a little bit differently. For example, the person was coming from an area of high community transmission. Whether or not that person who's coming has been practicing physical distancing, including mask use when they're on the plane. And, you know, a little bit more about information about that grandmother. Are they over 65? Do they have a way to adjust the situation and self-quarantine, for example, for 2 weeks if they feel there has been a exposure of some sort that is of concern.
Now, another listener is facing questions about their own return, and they wrote, I live in Ventura, California. I'm stranded on lockdown on the island of Kauai. Well, that's not a bad place to be locked down, right?
Yeah.
But my flight home 2 weeks ago was canceled due to the virus. When can I consider returning home? I am 70 and I have high blood pressure. So what do we know about flights during this time? According to the previous listener, a flight with their mother was able to come in from Mexico, but this person in Hawaii appears stranded. So what do you suggest there?
Yes, I think, again, it's kind of every situation is different depending on the specifics. Certainly a person who's greater than 70 years old, has high blood pressure, is currently in a very low risk area in Hawaii, then, that's probably a very safe place to be. And for example, they're staying at their second home in Hawaii. That might be the best place to remain for a while. But it's also going to have to be them deciding whether travel back is essential. For example, someone who maybe is working in a hospital setting back here in the mainland, needs to get back to work to help save all of us in case we get COVID-19, then that situation is a little bit different, needs to be considered.
What does the future of air travel look like, doctor, at least in the short term? What should people expect? I know that certain airlines are just barely, in the last week or so, forcing travelers to wear masks.
Yeah, I think so. We're going to see masking, for example, on airlines, frequent cleaning of high-touch surfaces, scanning documents or using contactless, boarding passes with your smartphone, hand sanitizer before boarding the flight. I think we'll be seeing, these types of guidance being done, not selling food on flights, things like that.
All right, Dr. Robert Kim Farley is with UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health, former staffer with the Centers for Disease Control. Doctor, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. And again, today we've just crossed 80,000 deaths in the United States. So again, people should recognize this is not something to be taken lightly. Yet at the same time, it is not an existential threat to mankind. We will get through this. There is a light ultimately at the end of this tunnel.
Thank you very much, Doctor. All right, there aren't many people that have gotten through the pandemic so far without suffering some kind of loss. For a lot of our neighbors, employment is a biggie, either losing hours or a job altogether. And when the numbers get boiled down, you start to see specific groups taking the biggest hits. Coming up, find out why women of color wound up being the workers suffering the most. That's coming up next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Women are experiencing higher rates of unemployment right now as the coronavirus pandemic drags down the economy. On Friday, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released a new report showing that unemployment among women reached 16.2% last month. That's 3 percentage points higher than men's. That news made us wonder what the economic landscape was like for female workers before all of this went down and what's at risk going forward. Joining us now is Maya Ragu. She's Director of Workplace Equality and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. Maya, thanks for joining us on Take Two.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, when you look at the unemployment numbers, what do you see in terms of how this economic crisis is affecting women?
Well, what we see is that women are on the front lines of this crisis in so many ways. Not only are they the majority of workers in many of the fields that are shedding jobs at an enormous rate right now, whether it's retail or service, like being waiters and waitresses, but they're also people who are first responders and providing essential services, like people in childcare or healthcare. So they are getting hit at both ends. Not only are they putting their lives on the line to provide the essential services to so many of us, but they are also getting hit by losing jobs in tremendous numbers in so many of these industries.
Maya, how do the numbers change when we look more closely at the race of the women who are losing their jobs?
So what we find is not even before the pandemic, women were the majority of people in many low-paid jobs, and particularly women of color. What we see in this crisis now is that women are the majority of workers in many of the industries that are shedding jobs and having huge layoffs. And many of them are also dominated by women of color. So for example, because travel has stopped now, maids and hotel housekeepers are losing their jobs at enormous rates. 88% of workers in those jobs were women, and 77% of them are women of color. Similarly, people who work in restaurants, high percentage of those workers are women. It's a job dominated by women, and about 40% of them are women of color.
And these are jobs that cannot be done via telecommuting, right? So that puts these women at an even bigger disadvantage.
That's right. There's no remote work when you work in the service industry in a restaurant.
And I guess I'm thinking, Maya, that the areas like tech or the STEM fields where women have historically been the minority, if more women were working in these areas, would the unemployment numbers be any different?
Well, I think it depends on the specific kinds of work that they were doing. Women were experiencing a gender wage gap across industries. So even if they were in STEM fields, they might have had more flexibility in being able to do their jobs remotely or being able to keep their jobs, but they still would have experienced an economic impact. And that's because, women across the board are losing income every month, every year, across their careers because of the gender wage gap. So they would still be at an economic disadvantage.
Maya, 2009, is that the time when President Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act?
That's right.
Yeah. So why do we still not have pay equality in the United States?
There are a lot of reasons for the gender wage gap. One of the biggest ones is the fact that the work that women do has always been undervalued. It underlies the discrimination and bias they face in jobs when it comes to getting equal pay. It plays a factor in the types of jobs that women can get and why they might be clustered in low-wage jobs. So over the years, there have been calls to strengthen our laws around pay discrimination, and the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act was an important step forward. We've seen states make these changes, but we haven't seen the legal change that we need at the federal level yet.
Now, another issue that's of concern is the progress that was made in the workplace before all this. And I'm thinking of the Me Too movement. How do you think this pandemic will affect the efforts to end sexual harassment and abuse in the workplace?
I think it's even more important than ever. And there was a lot of momentum before this pandemic, as you said, around addressing sexual harassment and violence in the workplace. We can't think about fighting discrimination as a luxury that we can't afford during a time of crisis. It's actually even more important than ever. And that's because when we are in the middle of a crisis like this one, it just exposes existing inequalities and makes it worse. If people are trying to hang on to their jobs, they're even more desperate than ever to keep a paycheck, they are more vulnerable to harassment and abuse.
I'm talking to Maya Raghu. She's a director of workplace equity and senior counsel at the National Women's Law Center. All right, so let's look at some solutions to help female workers adapt to this new reality. How about flex work plans or job sharing? Is that something that could be embraced more, or maybe it should be?
Yes, that's right. I think we're at a moment where we should be thinking big, and where we should be thinking about making big structural changes to change our economy and change our workplaces. And job sharing is something that has come up periodically over the years, but is now being taken, there's a much closer look being taken now. One of the biggest issues when we consider reopening the economy and reentry into jobs is this issue of childcare. It's a workforce that is dominated by women, but similarly, women need childcare before they can go back to the workplace. So part of the reason so many women work in part-time jobs is they needed the flexibility to deal with childcare. So any arrangement that gives women in particular more flexibility in terms of their hours and allows them to continue to work to support their families is an idea that should be explored.
Now, when you assess how women have been affected in terms of job loss, what's your biggest concern going forward?
It's a few different things. So as I just mentioned, women's work has traditionally been undervalued. In this crisis, the jobs that everyone is relying on, these essential services, are jobs largely being performed by women. So as we work our way out of this crisis, what we need is to make sure that these jobs, these essential jobs, you know, not only get premium pay in this crisis, but that they become jobs that are good quality jobs, that they pay fairly and well, that they come with important benefits, that people have access to high quality, affordable childcare. So that's one of the biggest transformations that needs to happen.
When it comes to being undervalued, and that sounds like a big societal issue, if people don't think they have value, or at least these jobs and these women have value, it's not going to change. Is it? Isn't that like a larger mindset that has to change before anything can really happen of substance?
Yes, but I think we are in a moment where that kind of change can happen, because people are realizing how important childcare providers are, how important healthcare providers are, domestic workers, people who work in grocery stores. Those are all jobs dominated by women. And if we want to make sure that we are helping people get out of this crisis, that the economy can restart, then women and women of color have to be at the center of that.
Maya Raghu is Director of Workplace Equality and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. Maya, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Orange County has been one of the battlegrounds over how and when Southern California should reopen. Going back to last week and through this weekend, some beaches and businesses either got or gave themselves the green light to open back up. Coming up, we'll hear how it all went, if it was done with state guidelines in mind, and where Orange County goes from here. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. All right, let's head down to Orange County, where some officials had been embroiled in a fight with the state over keeping beaches open. At the end of last week, some areas had won the right to allow access as long as they followed some strict guidelines. For more, we have with us Nick Gerda from the nonprofit news site Voice of OC. He joins us every Monday for an update on what's going on in the county. Hello, Nick.
Hey, great to see you.
All right. All right. Now, some beaches, such as Laguna and Newport, were open. Some were not. Remind us, Nick, what dictated whether or not this could happen?
That's right. There was a lot of uncertainty last week about whether beaches would open by the weekend in Orange County. And it turns out, at the end of the day, all of the city and county plans to reopen their beaches were approved last week by the governor's office. And beaches in OC were back open by the weekend with limitations. Officially, some beaches were only open for certain hours of the day. Some officially were closed over the weekend until the next week. But in large part, rules were pretty laxly enforced, and a lot of people were able able to come out. Generally, people were social distancing from what we could see, actually almost entirely, and people were able to enjoy the beaches. There were some legal challenges against the governor's closure directive of beaches that was from a couple weeks ago. Those lawsuits were filed by the city of Huntington Beach, a former leader of the California Republican Party, and a Newport Beach councilman. They were arguing there's a constitutional right to access the beaches and assemble at the beaches, and so far those legal challenges have been rejected by the courts, citing the governor's authority to protect public health.
Yeah, it was getting pretty testy between Orange County and the governor for a little while.
It was.
So you mentioned how generally people were keeping their distance from each other. Were people just enjoying themselves, at least in a safe way, from what you saw?
Yeah, you know, officially people weren't supposed to be lounging on the sand, according to the beach plans. But over the weekend, enforcement seemed to be pretty light in places like Seal Beach, where people were sitting on the sand. It seemed pretty much in households only at the beach. There wasn't too much of a police presence other than to close the beach for the night around 10:30 p.m. or so at night. It differs based on the city by city, but overall enforcement's been a pretty light touch according to police officials and what we're seeing on the ground. And officially people can use the beach to walk, run, surf, etc. But again, people are coming out to watch the bioluminescence.
So is that still happening down there? I know some people went to LA County to beaches there to see the water glow.
Yeah, we've been hearing it's been relocating north a bit. But over the weekend, it was happening in Orange County. There was some blue lights in the waves. Wow. People went out to the coast. Sometimes hard to catch, but with a big enough wave, it really glows up. And those aren't the only light phenomena at the beach in OC and in places like Seal Beach. There is a glow of oil tankers in the distance, many of them lining up, waiting to offload amid a collapse in demand for oil.
Somehow I think Californians like the bioluminescence one more than the oil takers in general.
You know,
just the way we are, I think. Now, much like in Los Angeles, some businesses also got to reopen in Orange County. Did retail shops do this? And you got a sense over how it went for most. So was business being done in a safe way?
Yeah, it's a mixture of businesses that have opened and not. There's been several business owners saying that they have been planning to reopen their salons, martial arts studios, and restaurants starting this week, citing a difficulty making ends meet. But officially, the state orders, for the most part, do not allow those types of businesses to be open, at least for customers coming in. As far as we can tell, most restaurants are still closed to dining in. And for those that do plan to open, they say they've been getting mixed messages from their city police and some county supervisors about whether they can reopen and that they're willing to roll the dice and see what happens.
Yeah, there's some tension over how these restaurants will be opening in a larger way beyond what they're already doing, which is pickup and delivery. I mean, I guess in some ways it's understandable. If you open a little bit, everyone's wondering what the next step is going to be and they want to know as soon as possible.
Exactly. And there's been a lot of mixed messages here and there, different messages from county officials. Officially, the county guidelines say to follow the state orders, which do not allow in-person dining or in dining inside restaurants. A different message was sent when two county supervisors in Orange County, Don Wagner and Michelle Steele, indicated the county would not be enforcing those state orders against restaurants like Nomad's Canteen down in San Clemente, which had reopened for in-person bar service and restaurant service. And really became a flashpoint in this debate. Last we checked, county staff are saying the restaurant inspectors are expected to enforce the state closure orders, starting with verbal warnings and then written warnings and ultimately potentially a pulling of a permit. As of late last week, there was no word of the county actually taking back its warning against Nomads, which had plans to reopen last Thursday, but it remains to be seen how this will all play out and to what extent there will be enforcement or not. County staff are saying that their focus is on getting voluntary compliance before moving to pull permits. But several business owners are saying that they're going to proceed with opening.
One more thing, Nick. In LA and Orange County, we get the daily report on how many cases of COVID-19 there are, how many deaths and hospitalizations, but there's not a lot of data on how many people have recovered. Is there a movement in Orange County to have those numbers reported?
Yeah, this is something a lot of people have been asking for, including in the health profession, just data on how many people have recovered. We see the number of people who've been reported to have infections and deaths, and people say they want to see a bit of hope. And even on the medical side, they want to better understand the disease and how long immunity might last. And sort of tracking recoveries is a key part of that. And in kind of the fragmented health system, there really isn't apparently a centralized place that's collecting that data or the data is being reported to. So we've been asking about it. County supervisor has been asking about it. And the county is telling us now that they're starting to look at how to collect it. They don't have a date yet for when they're going to be posting data on how many people have been recovering. But officials say to stay tuned for tomorrow's meeting of the County Board of Supervisors, where they plan to talk more about their plans to put out the recovery data.
All right, that's Nick Gerda with the Voice of OC. Nick, as always, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, now to your stories. KPCC and LAS are documenting life in the new normal with video diaries from everyday Angelenos. Here's one from one of the thousands of school teachers who are really missing their kids right now.
My name is Roy Lansdowne. It is Wednesday, April 22nd, I think. Days tend to run together when you're on quarantine. I teach film production and journalism at Bell High School in the proud city of Bell. This is the difference between distance teaching and going to school. You don't get to make breakfast like this when you're teaching at school. And you can probably hear Air Talk and Larry Mantle in the background. Although right now,
I'm in my front yard, and this is where I sit and make videos that I post for my students to give them lessons and direction and feedback. But today's going to be a little bit different because today I'm going into school.
Of course, since there will be a few other people here, it's time to mask on.
Hey,
another day in paradise.
Our assistant principals and our principal out in front with our magnet coordinator giving out Chromebooks to students that need them. They're doing everything they can to make this work. Everything they can. And here's my classroom. My board is still up from our last day of class, the fateful Friday the 13th. Boy, I miss this place. You have no idea.
You can watch all of Mr. Lansdowne's video diary and submit your own at laist.com. That's laist.com. All right, if you missed any part of Take Two today, you know we're on at 2 o'clock. Come on, make an effort. We're making an effort on our end. But if you missed any part of it today and you want to hear what happened, just go to wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can even go back and listen to some of the stuff we did last week, too. There's good stuff there as well. We're also all over social media, so just find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter, and it's good for Instagram. There you go. Social media convenience right there at your fingertips. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.